History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And they really don't have to go untold, as long as some of us are willing to ask a few questions and then to listen patiently as memories that could have been buried for decades take on new life in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's episode was recorded in a beautiful city of a little less than 1,500 people that's known as the birthplace of Montana. There is some fascinating history to explore in Fort Benton, Montana, and if you ever make it out this way, you really ought to track down Durrell Gibbs, a real Montana cowboy who survived the Battle of Okinawa during World War II and had one unforgettable incident within that battle come full circle with a special element of closure decades after the war. We're going to get to all of that, but as always, it's best if we begin at the beginning.
I spent the first 7 years of my life in Portage, Utah. Portage is just 17 miles south of Malad, Idaho, so the border between Utah and Idaho. That's where I spent the first 7 years of my life, and it was great there at Portage. Everybody, they milked their cows out in the corral, and when they got through milking cows, they'd open the gate and the cows would go out on the street. And now this is in the early 30s. Depression was on. Two-thirds of the kids in town, it seemed like, had a desert Mustang for saddle horse. We'd start at the top of the town every morning, and as we come down through the town, why, we'd gather all the cows up that was along the streets, and we'd take them down on the Malad River. There was a community pasture there. We'd take those cows down to that pasture about a mile, and at night we'd gather the cows up, drive them back up to town, and the cows pretty well knew where their place was, so I guess that's where I got the fondness of working cows and horseback.
So how old were you when you were doing that?
Oh, I had to be probably 5. I hadn't started school yet. There was a fellow in town that was manager for the Ogden State Bank sheep herd. He'd hire the herders, of course. There was no jobs available. My dad was a camp tender, and they was down on the Nevada desert. And there was lots of Mustangs down there. So anytime they caught a Mustang, and they'd bring him up, and some kid in town would have a saddle horse. We didn't have saddles, of course. We rode bareback, but it was a great way to grow up. Everybody was the same, and no sugar, or they didn't have money enough to buy sugar, and everything was a community affair. In the fall, if you had pigs to butcher, well, everybody in town that had a pig to butcher got their hogs butchered, and it was just that way of laying food away. Kind of comical. I don't remember, but they tell me enough so that I feel like I remember it. My dad and mother had a discussion about going down to see my dad's sister. It was 25 miles is all. But in the 30s, the Depression was on. My dad said, oh, we don't have enough gas in the car to drive down to Lena's. So I went out and I got the hose and I stuck it in the gas tank and filled it up. And I went in and told my dad and mom, I said, your tank's full. I filled it up with the garden hose. So, and you know what that was. So there, that's just one of the many incidents that I grew up with.
Well, I've got a lot of questions after that. I mean, first of all, a lot of people listening, they hear you say Mustang, and they're just thinking about the car. I mean, Ford has kind of taken over proprietary rights on that name. But you're talking about wild horses that you guys would get a hold of. And a lot of five-year-olds imagine themselves becoming cowboys. They dream about being a cowboy. But what you're saying is you were a bareback cowboy herding cows at age five.
Well, yeah, for the town, I mean, everybody had 2, 3, 4, 5 milk cows, and we just go out in the, they didn't go put them in a barn and have milkers. We'd just go out with a stool and sit down, and we'd milk the cow just out in the corral. When the cows would haul milk, everybody just opened the gate and let the cows go in the street. We'd gather the cows.
And I've got to ask you, too, and I know you kept riding horses till you were 90 years old. You've spent a lot of your life on horseback, but as that five-year-old riding a Mustang, were there some misadventures? Did you end up on the ground a few times?
Oh, yes. But then that was just part of growing up. I mean, we it was no big deal. Everything was community involved. Looking back, those were great times. A lot of people didn't have sugar, couldn't afford the sugar. But everyone was the same, you know? So it seems like maybe when times are the toughest, that's you remember back, and those were good memories.
And when you were 7, you moved to Idaho?
Yeah. My dad was the youngest one in the family, and my Uncle Cy was the oldest. My dad's father died at an early age, and my Uncle Cy had to take over. He had to look after the family. My Uncle Cy was elected mayor of Portage. He was mayor for 27 years. So it was great. And it is great right today to go up to the Portage Cemetery, and I think I'm related to everybody in that cemetery. So, in looking back, those were great carefree days. I compare that to some kids that grew up on the street. Thank goodness, I just thank the Lord, but nobody had any money, and I started school in Portage, and we moved to Idaho. My dad would work in the sugar company factory in the fall up at in Idaho at Blackfoot. My dad moved up there, and he worked on a farm, run a farm for a fellow that was an official in the sugar company. So that's how we got to Blackfoot. That's where I grew up. After that, I graduated out of high school there.
Do you remember at a young age having an idea in your mind, hey, when I grow up, this is the kind of life I'm going to have, or who I'm going to be, what I'm going to do?
Well, I always liked to be around animals. Cows. Yeah, all those years as I was growing up, I just, well, always had a saddle horse. I enjoyed riding and working with a horse. So I guess you could say that. I was always aware of how people helped each other, their outlook toward people. I just grew up as a common kid, I guess. And the older I got, the more I wanted to have a cattle ranch.
And I know it's a good thing you ended up moving to Blackfoot because you might not have met your wife otherwise. But, you know, what about those high school years? Did you have any inclination that war was coming before it showed up?
Let's see. It seems like I was in my sophomore year when the Japanese hit Pearl Harbor. And all of that, you know, how a country is, all of a sudden they're in war. And it was amazing to see what our country I think back of the 40s and the 50s, and I feel bad because I think our generation and the generation right behind us fell down on responsibilities, because today, how many kids in our country know that you cannot find anything older on a vehicle, 43, 44, 45, those 3 years, there's no vehicles on the road. No combines was built. Everything went to the war effort. And with that kind of a pull, we was fighting a war on two fronts, and we won because everybody was working together. And when I compare that today, it's unbelievable. So my favorite time when I look at my country and everything, I say how united we was, and then today how divided. It's scary.
Well, and the spark for all of that, the thing that brought so many people together, was the surprise attack, and you just made reference to it, December 7th, 1941. Seems like everybody has a pretty specific memory. who was alive that day. Where were you? What were you doing? And how'd you find out?
Well, I guess we went to school that morning, and that was the topic. They hit us on Sunday, well, Monday morning, and, you know, it was a total surprise to the nation. We didn't know Japan was ready to do something like that, so it was a total surprise. And that morning we went to school, man, that was the topic at school. Of course, then as I went to the next few years at school, there was people enlisting and going to the fight. And, you know, there would be the women would go build ships, be welders and everything. And it was a wonderful experience to see how the country was pulling. And then here, by the time I graduated out of school, I knew I didn't have a chance to enlist. They were waiting for me. And right out of school, just a few months, you know how the chain of command has to work. It takes some months. I went to the Army and done my basic training in Camp Hood, Texas. They call it Fort Hood now, but that was Camp Hood. As soon as that basic was done, I was on my way to the Pacific.
And I want to talk to you about that, but I'm curious about something else, too. So you're in high school. Pearl Harbor's bombed. You said it wasn't too long. Guys started signing up. But another thing happened. A few months after Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt issued an executive order that basically made Japanese Americans on the West Coast, whether they were citizens or not, made them enemies of the state. They were classified 4C enemy alien and weren't allowed to serve in the military. And then they got sent away from the coast because that seemed like a risk and sent to these internment camps. And you said there was a camp not too far from where you were, where some Japanese were sent?
Oh, yes. I'd go by that camp every day, and I wasn't aware at the time of the stress they must have felt of being uprooted. It isn't unreal to think that they could have been sending messages, or, you know, to their country. Let's turn it around. Say the U.S. had hit Japan, and there was lots of U.S. citizens in Japan. What would Japan have done? But these internment camps, I was never in one, but they could do their things every day, but they had to leave their businesses and that, and it was no doubt a hardship. But we all was working for the betterment of the country.
You know, you mentioned going to Camp Hood for basic training. Was that a piece of cake for you, or were there any moments that were kind of, hey, this isn't necessarily going to be easy?
I was slow in growing up. I grew up more after I got in the Army than I did for the several years before I went to the service. And yes, it was a challenge for me on those forced marches and stuff like that. I was on the smaller soldiers there. I was one of the smallest ones. I found that's where I had to pay a lot of attention to detail because like on a forced march, it'd be at night, and we'd be marching maybe 15, 20 miles with a full field pack and a rifle, and we would march for 50 minutes, and then we'd fall out for 10. That takes up an hour, and then we'd do that just regular. Well, I found out that when we fell out after marching 50 minutes on that 10-minute reprieve, I found out that if I laid in the bar pit with my head downhill and my feet up, I laid there for 10 minutes, and when I fell back in to start the march, that's what kept me going, because that laying down with my head downhill and my feet up, I could gain that 10 minutes. It gained me time.
Was there any particular aspect of the training you received that in hindsight you say, you know, that was really helpful and that paid some dividends when I actually ended up in combat?
Oh, yeah. I had a buddy. There were several of us, like in bayonet training, you know. Howard Keller, he and I had talked back and forth about that bayonet training. We had both agreed. I said, man, I don't know why we are doing all this. I said, if it come down to bayonets, I'd throw my gun at them and I'd outrun them to the ocean. And we both figured, well, that's what we do. But you had to go through the training. Howard, his last name was Keller. My being Gibbs, why, a lot of times when you're split up, they take what your last, like G's, all the G's would come over here, K's would be over there. So when we shipped out, when we went overseas, why, we got in different outfits that way. But we was in the same division. He was in another company, and there was a time when we was all at night, you'd dig in foxholes, and that was the way you spent the night. That was protocol. Well, the Japanese had come up, snuck in really close, and just as the crack of dawn, jumped in there and hollering banzai, and it was bayonets. And I looked over there, and Howard, here, there was a Japanese soldier running toward Howard, and instead of throwing his gun and racing to the ocean, Howard is running to meet the Japanese soldier. And the rifles, you know, in what they taught, and the Japanese rifle went sailing up there, and that was it. So that sticks in my mind how that's what we's going to do. Your training takes over. I asked Howard afterward, I said, what was you thinking about? And he said, Darrell, he said, my mind just, I wasn't thinking about nothing. He said that everything he done was what training took over.
And the courage is summoned in a moment like that. You mentioned, you know, heading overseas, and I'm curious about that. Had you ever been on a ship before?
No, but here's all these guys from all different walks of life, and we're all doing the same thing. You just fall in a pattern. No, I'd never been on a ship before, and it was funny. We laugh at anything. The first time over, and the roughest time, is when you're getting the ground swells closer to the land. The further out the ocean you get, there's sometimes it can be just as smooth and nice. But the ground swells, you get out 4 or 5 hours, it's pretty rough. And I tell about how everybody is seasick and throwing up. And so you're on the decks, out there on those steel decks. When you're like that, it don't matter whether the sun's up or down or what, you're sick. And the sailors, those guys, boy, they got a remedy for that. They just turned the hoses on, quite a bit of pressure, and they'd wash down the decks, and you'd be right out there. They'd wash you down, you know. So you was glad to see it coming. It didn't matter if that's just the way it was. People don't stop to think about things like that, and all of a sudden, you're there.
It's time for our first break, but when we come back, we'll find out what Durrell Gibbs experienced once he made it overseas, fighting in the Battle of Okinawa with the 96th Infantry Division. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video with this 97-year-old Montana cowboy, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.